From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FM.
Yes, thank you, Simon. Thank you very much indeed. Well, welcome to Wednesday's programme. Are you well? It's October 14th. It's 2020. Not a bad day at all today here in Salford. Hope you're well. Thanks for joining me. Let's get on with it.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, Michael O'Brien is a very well-known man in Wales and in the UK. He spent 11 years in jail for a murder he did not commit. Some of you will remember the Cardiff Newsagent 3 case. Anyway, Michael is taking the Welsh First Minister to court, claiming that the lockdown has cost him his relationship with his partner. Michael reached out to the programme. I got back to him and he joins me on the programme in around about 25 minutes time. You do not want to miss that. That is Wednesday's programme, and I would expect to hear from you through the course of the programme on Twitter. You know how to reach me by now, so do drop me a tweet and share the programme with others. Let others know that it is around and that it is live and interactive. That's the nice thing, isn't it? Not so much of that around these days. A live and interactive radio programme. I'm going to tempt fate here. I shouldn't. Ordinarily, there are more fireworks going off round about now. You know, a couple of weeks, just over a couple of weeks to Halloween. You'd normally hear the banging and the madness and the fireworks and the terrified dogs running for cover. But it's quiet-ish. Hope I haven't blown that, by the way. Hope I haven't blown it. But it is quiet around for this time of year. Schools will close in Northern Ireland from Monday, along with pubs and restaurants, cafes. As Arlene Foster told us today, the First Minister of Northern Ireland, it's a full lockdown, effectively, in the north. The moves are among new restrictions being imposed by the executive there. Why? Well, because of rising cases. It was announced that 4 more people had died with COVID-19 on Wednesday in Northern Ireland. 4 more deaths with COVID. It's beautiful, the language. Hospitality businesses will be limited to takeaway and delivery services for 4 weeks from Friday. Now, you will know, if you're paying attention here in Blighty, that there's a big row brewing. Astonishingly, the leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, sir, if you please, well, he's basically been criticising the government's introducing of the new 3-tier system. Starmer says, we need a full lockdown or a circuit breaker. They've introduced the term circuit breaker because it doesn't sound as bad as lockdown, even though it is pretty much full lockdown. Starmer wants another lockdown. Yes, I know, the party of the working class, and the working man and woman, indeed. Anyway, I'm not going to subject you to any of the exchange between Johnson and Starmer at PMQs today because I don't think you deserve it, dear listener. You've been quite good this week. Who needs to hear it? I've just told you, you don't need to hear it. Pictures of large crowds gathering in Liverpool last night at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, half 11, have shamed Liverpool, according to the mayor, Joe Anderson. Footage on social media showed people dancing and surrounding a police car in Concert Square at 10 o'clock last night. Now, one of those who took the photographs, amongst those photographing and filming the scene was none other than Inzamam Rashid. Now, Inzamam is a reporter for Sky News. So he filmed some of the young revelers last night. Why were they out dancing? Well, Liverpool is going into Tier 3 tonight. Basically, all pubs and bars and restaurants to be closed, more or less. The ones that don't serve food, right? Dreadful stuff. Terrible for Liverpool. So Inzamam Rashid filmed this. It was on Sky today. It shamed Liverpool, said the mayor. Here's what Inzamam Rashid had to say about the scene that unfolded at Concert Square last night.
Doctors, intensive care doctors from hospitals in Liverpool have been watching the footage that we've just seen of party scenes last night, a couple of hours before the Tier 3 lockdown restrictions were implemented here in Liverpool. They've been watching that footage and they're quite frankly disgusted. Many are heartbroken to see what was happening in Liverpool.
Doctors are disgusted and heartbroken that youngsters were dancing around in Concert Square.
Well, last night, I've been speaking to ICU doctors late last night, this morning as well, some telling me that they were disgusted by the scenes, that they were hugely annoyed and disappointed. They say that we are putting our lives at risk for these people. Another one went on to say that...
Oh my God, we are putting our lives at risk for these people.
That these people don't care and people are dying from the disease. It's heartbreaking to watch this. This was a street party that continued after the 10 p.m. curfew and bars and pubs had shut in Liverpool last night and just hours before the Tier 3 lockdown restrictions came into force. Jo Anderson, the mayor of Liverpool, coming out and speaking today as well. He said that these pictures are a shame to our city.
A shame to our city. People dancing and enjoying themselves in Concert Square. What is on the mind? What was going through the minds of those young men and women last night? Lawrence Buckman.
Enjoy yourself and kill a granny is the answer.
Exactly. We're going to have a good crack and, well, if we kill a granny, so be it. Do you believe you're living through this, you know? Well, look, if you can't beat him, join him. Down with that sort of thing, I say.
Down with this sort of thing.
Careful now.
Down with this sort of thing.
Down with that sort of thing. Yeah, that was in Liverpool last night. Like I said, Keir Starmer wants national lockdown for a few weeks. Johnson says no, but then he says we might have one. We'll see. Kids having the crack at Concert Square. Reuters reported last night, this is obviously an international news agency, Reuters. It reported last night on wearable technology, wearable, that we might all have to wear soon. It's a necklace, you see. What does it do, BBG? Well, it warns us when we are less than 2 metres away from another human being and thus in danger, presumably, of spreading the virus. It's called Bump. It's called Bump. It's a necklace. Looks like a little pendant and it lights up and it tells you to get away from the person you're getting too close to. And it was used at the London Marathon. Here's Reuters.
A necklace encouraging you to keep a social distance. Meet Bump, the wearable device that helped this year's London Marathon take place despite restrictions due to COVID-19. Andrew Nicholson is the group marketing manager at Tharsis, Bump's developer.
Bump's a wearable device around your neck and it makes two signals, blue when you're 2 metres away from another Bump wearer and red and a loud beep when you're 1 metre away.
Wow.
The device was worn by the 100 elite athletes and 500 race staff to help maintain the biosecure bubble ahead of the marathon on October 4, alerting the wearer when they came within 2 metres of another device.
Danger. You're getting too close to somebody. So it's called Bump. The London Marathon director reckons we can all wear it to get back to normal.
The London Marathon's director, Hugh Brasher, believes the technology can go beyond marathons.
I think that this technology can be used in business, really importantly. If companies trying to come back to the office, so many conversations going on about how do you ensure someone's safety, health and safety is so important these days, not only offices but warehousing. And absolutely, could it be used in marathons in the future? Yes, but I think it's much wider about how it can be used to get us back to some form of normality.
Get us back to normal. And I was reading about Bump online, but this is true. You can see this if you go online and look for it. It has been embraced. It is being embraced by company directors. Business owners are embracing this and are basically saying, we're going to buy these and give them to our employees. And you will walk around the office now with one of these around your neck, alongside the laminate that you wear to identify yourself, the laminate even that you would use to get into the building. You'll wear your Bump now and it will tell you when you're too close to your mate that you've worked alongside for years. And presumably when you're entering your place of work, security guard will ask to see your Bump and you'll be sent home if you don't have the Bump. Go back home and get it and come back. You can't go in without your Bump. Yeah. Kay Burley of Sky News, the Ginger Ninja. She reckons, thus Kay, today, that it is vital we get the flu jab, but even more importantly, it's important, even more importantly, that our children get the flu jab. Have you ever wondered what an infomercial sounds like? Have you ever wondered what news... Say it again, Richie. Have you ever wondered what an infomercial masquerading as news sounds like? Aha, that's more like it. Infomercial masquerading as news. Well, here it is. Listen, feast your ears. This is wonderful.
Well, this year, getting a flu vaccination is more important than ever before. Last winter, less than 45% of eligible children got their flu jab. But this year, the government is hoping to increase that to 75% to help them get there. They have enlisted presenter and parent, of course, Mylene Klass. She is with us now. Hello to you, Mylene. A very good morning to you. Why is this campaign so important to you?
Yeah, we'll come back to Mylene Klass in a moment. So Kay thinks it's important that we bump up those figures. What were those numbers again last year as opposed to what they want this year?
Before last winter, less than 45% of eligible children got their flu jab. But this year, the government is hoping to increase that to 75%.
Yeah. So they've enlisted the help of Mylene Klass, a singer who once found fame winning the first Pop Idol with a girl band. She's going to persuade more yummy mummies to give their kids the flu vaccine. I wouldn't throw Mylene out of bed for eating crisps now, it must be said. Why, Mylene, why have you taken it upon yourself to join this campaign to get more children to get the flu vax? Why?
Well, I'm a mum of three children, and I think there's so much confusion out there. We hear so many mixed messages as to why you shouldn't get the flu vaccine. And I think there's a real fear. So if I want to come out in solidarity and reassure parents that it's definitely something that I will be doing. And especially with the current climate of us searching for vaccines, we have a flu vaccine, and it's something that we can take into our own control and look after our families with. So it's definitely something that all of my family going to have, including my baby, because you can actually pass the vaccine on through breastfeeding, and my partner as well, who I'm going to make sure he gets vaccinated. It's not just for children, it's the whole family.
She's going to vaccinate the entire borough where she lives if she gets the chance, Mylene Klass. You did catch that bit there, didn't you, in the middle? I had to do a double take myself.
All of my family going to have, including my baby, because you can actually pass the vaccine on through breastfeeding.
You can pass it on through breastfeeding.
What kind of fuckery is this?
Yeah. I'd say it's fuckery, Amy, to be honest. All of my family are going to have it, including my baby, because I'll pass it on to her through breastfeeding. This is beautifully choreographed, this. Mylene has her lines. Kay has her lines. It's an infomercial. Do you think that a hack like Kay Burley doesn't know that children these days take it through a nasal spray and don't get the needle? Do you think that Kay doesn't know that? Of course Kay knows that. That's why it's an infomercial. They have their lines. This is dire.
Okay, so adults, we know that we need to have a jab. What about for kids? Because, you know, little ones don't like injections at the best of times, do they?
See, Kay's reading her script there. Kay knows the answer, that it's a nasal spray. Shocking, this, isn't it?
No, and do you know what? It's so annoying because so many people think, myself included, by the way, I've got it wrong in the past, that you have to have a jab. It's been labelled as the flu jab. But actually, for the age groups that we're talking about, 2 years old, upwards, up to I think it's 12 years old, they have a spray. Well, there's nothing frightening in any way about a spray. In fact, my daughter looks forward to it. She's 9 years old. She likes getting in the queue at school, and she likes the fact that it just tickles. And so I think if you actually dispel the fear and the myth that it's going to hurt, and actually show them that they're empowering themselves. Every day we tell our children to wash their hands and know how to protect themselves against the COVID virus. Here, we're going to be able to empower our children to protect themselves against the flu virus.
Empower our children.
Virus. And goodness, you know, we certainly don't want the combination of the two at the moment. Mm.
And it's a nasal spray, isn't it? I think I'm right in saying.
Yeah, you know it is, you ginger. You know.
It is a nasal spray. It's literally a matter of seconds and you have the flu vaccine in a spray form. It doesn't hurt.
Doesn't hurt. My daughter can't wait. She queues up for it. Yeah, I don't believe that for a minute. Any side effects?
Okay. And as far as any sort of side effects are concerned, because I think I'm right in saying that they give you a little tiny bit of flu in order for you to build up your antibodies against it.
This is an infomercial.
What about parents who might be concerned that that might have a negative impact on their kids?
So there are so many parents that are given the wrong information as to if you get the flu vaccine, then you could potentially get the flu. You might have a small reaction to it, or you might show when the flu vaccine goes into you, you might exhibit slight signs of what that reaction looks like, but it won't be like the full-blown flu. And when you think of, you know, the fact that economically, would you have to take extra days off work if your child did get the flu, or yourself as well, it makes sense for the entire family just to make sure they are vaccinated.
Mm. You've been listening to an infomercial produced by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, starring Kay Burley as herself and Mylene Klass as a scab. Where's the bucket of tar and the wheelbarrow of feathers, eh? When you need it? Shocking stuff, that, isn't it? Isn't it? I've begun to believe, and I have no evidence to support this, so it's conjecture, it's just an opinion. And partly because a year and a half, maybe 3 years ago, when I was in Fallowfield and I was having a checkup, I was having a blood test done at my local doctor, and the nurse said to me that the flu vaccine they were administering this particular year seemed to be making a lot of people unwell. Now, I told you this. She wouldn't go on the record. Well, when I say she wouldn't go on the record, I didn't ask her to go on the record. She didn't know anything about me or what I was doing at the time, but she said to me, everybody who's gotten it in the surgery has come down with a very heavy dose. And I remember that particular morning, the woman working on reception was in a bad way. Very bad way. Very bad way. And I asked her, was she all right? And she said, yeah, I'm struggling, finding it pretty difficult. And I said, you had the vaccine? She went, yeah. But it's unusual, she said, that you would, you know, end up like me. But the nurse had previously said to me 5 minutes earlier that a lot of people were like that. So I began to think, maybe you wouldn't have so much flu in the winter if there was no flu vaccine at all. I don't know. Just my opinion. It's not my opinion. It's a question. Would we have less flu without the flu vaccine? I don't know. Staying with vaccines just for the moment, Kate Bingham is heading up the UK Vaccine Task Force. Right, she's heading up the UK Vaccine Task Force. She was on the radio, BBC Radio 5, with Rachel Burden. Burden asked her this question.
When we get this vaccine, does it mean everything back to normal? Will we be magically released from all these restrictions?
Will we? Will we? Will we?
I mean, again, a million-dollar question. I can't answer that until we see the data. So, again, it will depend how effective these vaccines are and on whom. I'd just be speculating to say that it'll all be fantastic. I think it's highly unlikely everybody will be protected forever with these vaccines. I just don't think that's going to happen yet. But I think we will be managing it more effectively. We've got more and more therapeutics which are managing the severity of symptoms for people who do get infected. And I think it is possible that we're going to need to continue to revaccinate people after they've had the initial vaccination in order to maintain that immune protection. So will we get back exactly to normal immediately? No. Will we get back to a working life that I think will be much more closer to normal than close to lockdown? By the end of 21, I'm sure we would do.
Mm. Will we get back to normal straight away? No. Who are these people? Huh? Who are these people? 22 minutes past five. Michael O'Brien joining us live in about 10 minutes time. James O'Brien presents for LBC. He's one of the worst radio presenters in the history of radio. That isn't conjecture either. That's a fact. Garbage. London School of Economics graduate, moron, not a journalist. Don't know how he ended up at LBC, but he did. Dreadful. Presented Newsnight for a short time, then he got pissed off at the BBC, or they got pissed off at him and they got rid of him. O'Brien is dreadful. He wants shitloads of lockdown, does James O'Brien. He wants loads of it, more of it. Here is O'Brien arguing with a listener. Now, the listener has said there should be some herd immunity, some return to normal, while being careful. Listen to the prat that is James O'Brien on LBC today. It doesn't get any worse than this, believe me, and we've heard a lot of bad stuff.
I mean, normally these military analogies are appalling, but mine's very loose and I think therefore a little bit more effective. The enemy is at the gate. The engines of war are catapulting virus into our midst.
Catapulting virus into our midst. You've got to hear this again to believe you heard it.
I mean, normally these military analogies are appalling, but mine's very loose and I think therefore a little bit more effective. The enemy is at the gate. The engines of war are catapulting virus into our midst, or enemies into our midst. And we've decided this time we're not going to fight it tooth and nail. We're going to try and sort of lock that tower over there on a Tuesday and lock that tower over there on a Thursday and everybody...
Lock that tower over there and lock that one over there. We should be locking everything down, says James O'Brien, who gets a six-figure salary from LBC. He's got a very nice house in the country, a very nice flat in London. He's never wanted for a thing in his life. Comes from a wealthy family. Little Lord, I'm not going to say it. Never has had to cope with poverty. Never had to wonder where the next meal is coming from. So he can sit there in Leicester Square, which is where LBC is based, and say things like, the enemy is at the gate flinging coronavirus over the walls. And all we're doing is closing this tower on a Tuesday and this tower on a Thursday. We need to be locking everything down. This is the media in 2020, imagine. Imagine it. It goes on.
But it can hide in the dungeons on a Friday and hopefully the enemy will just sort of run out of puff and go home.
Well, no, I think we are getting some results, though. They're
I hope
using
so.
Steroids now. They're saying that.
Oh, that's very different. That's very different. That's treating people who have caught it. That's not stopping people from catching it. And I do insist on that distinction being observed.
I insist on that distinction being observed. Never been a violent man, me. In terms of what I mean by that is, I've never been somebody who has ever resolved to settle a dispute or an argument with violence, and I never will be. Wouldn't mind 5 minutes in a room with James O'Brien, though. You know?
Yes, but we must get a herd immunity, surely.
There's no such thing. We haven't even got herd immunity for the flu.
Well, we have something, don't we?
No.
I suppose we have a vaccine. You're right, we have a vaccine.
Herd immunity is a myth.
There is no such... It doesn't work with this?
In the context of coronavirus and COVID, we're just hearing about people coming, dying, having been infected for a second time is in today's news.
That's a massive lie. We've been hearing about people dying, having had coronavirus for a second time. That hasn't been substantiated, that. It hasn't. There's been a story about some kid in Nevada who might have had it twice, but there's no evidence, there's no corroborated evidence that somebody has had it twice and died. It's just nonsense. This is your media, 2020. What do you do about that? What can you do about it? Violence is right out. Can't be violent. Must never be violent. Must never attack or assault anybody. Must never threaten anybody. What do you do about people like that? Who's selling out his fellow man and woman on a daily basis. And he's not alone, of course, in it. You've got Piers Morgan on ITV. You've got the Sky News presenters. They know this is nonsense. Outside of that, you've got Peter Hitchens in the Daily Mail. You've got Alison Pearson in the Telegraph. You've got people like James Dellingpole. You've got you've got Spiked Online, Brendan O'Neill, a few others. But the majority of them, 99 out of 100 of them, are selling this. And they know they're selling it to the public. They're selling it. They're not challenging it. They're not questioning it. They're not pulling it asunder. Even though it would be like taking sweets, we say here, from a child. It's that easy to dismantle this nonsense now. The arbitrary measures. The data that doesn't add up. The fake PCR test which doesn't work. The lies. The death numbers themselves. So easy to rip it to shreds. What's going on with these journalists and these presenters? So what do you do? How do you deal with it? Outside of attacking people and and nobody should ever do that. You attack somebody, you deserve to be in prison. You go up to somebody and punch them in the face, you deserve to go to court for it. It's not the right thing to do. I see people on Twitter all the time, we have to deal with these people. No, you don't. Not like that. It's what the system wants. There has to be another way. I don't know what it is, though, because time is running out. That was the news roundup for Wednesday, the 14th of October. James O'Brien doesn't know the first thing about herd immunity. He's a London School of Economics educated muppet who fell into radio somehow. Got no skill, got no talent, got no charisma. Wouldn't be presenting on radio 25, 30 years ago. Wouldn't have gotten inside the door. But there he is now today selling the agenda. And I suppose that's the answer to how, in the name of God, does a moron like that get on the radio? I've probably answered my own question. Here's Bobby Darin, back in a moment with Michael O'Brien.
With a shark bait.
Said Jenny Diver.
Right, that is Bobby Darin on the Richie Allen Radio Show. It's 29 minutes to the top of the hour. If you're just tuning in, you're very welcome. Good to be with you this Wednesday. Drive time, strange times, eh? I was jogging down Liverpool Street this morning, heading for Regent Road, around about 25 past nine. And I know I've said this before, but it gets me every time. You would expect to see it jammed with traffic going in both directions. Extraordinary to see it with a couple of cars here, a couple of cars there. Strange old times. Let me read you from the South Wales Echo, if you don't mind. From Friday's edition. Solicitors acting for a man who says his relationship with his partner broke down because of lockdown restrictions have written to First Minister Mark Drakeford to tell him he will be the respondent in a High Court legal challenge. Michael O'Brien, who is bringing the action, is well known as one of the Cardiff newsagent three who spent 11 years in prison for a murder they did not commit before their convictions were quashed. Now Mr. O'Brien, who currently lives near Aberdare, has instructed his solicitors to use human rights legislation to challenge the lockdown regulations. And Michael reached out to us, to me, over the weekend. I'm glad he did. Let's welcome him to the programme. Michael, lovely to meet you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
What a story you have, Michael. I mean, reading about you today, your own personal story before all of this, it's the stuff of, you know, legend, really, the sort of thing you'd expect to see in a film. We might touch on a little bit of that later on. Thanks for coming on today. So tell us what happened then. Sorry, genuinely sorry to hear that your relationship broke down. I do hear from a lot of people who tell me that because of the lockdown, especially when they weren't living with their partner or girlfriend or boyfriend, that it put a big strain on their relationship. Tell us about yourself. What happened exactly?
Well, what happened? I met a young lady a couple of months ago, you know, I mean, and trying to build up a relationship with her. And, you know, then the COVID restrictions came into force and I wasn't allowed to see her. I haven't seen her for over a month. And how are you supposed to keep a relationship going in those circumstances? You can't do it by telephone. And, you know, I wasn't allowed in her house. She wasn't allowed in my house. And yet we live in the same borough. I mean, it's really absurd, you know, the COVID restrictions that they're placing on. You know, what about the right to family life? You know, the right to start a family or whatever you want to do. And I feel very angry that I was in a good position at one stage. You know, I thought we were getting along fine, and it just got too much for both of us. You know, bearing in mind that I suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder because I was wrongfully imprisoned, and I still feel like even though I'm outside because of the restrictions, I feel like I can't move, and I still feel like I'm still in prison in my mind.
Yeah, I met a couple, Michael. I was thinking of you. I was thinking of the couple today when I was reading up about you. I met a couple in a park in Salford a few months ago, and a bit younger than us, it must be said, a bit younger than us, and they were not cohabiting, and they were talking to me about the difficulties of not being able to go to one another's houses. The only time they met was in the park with their dogs, and I asked them, and I wasn't being cheeky or I wasn't, you know, trying to insult them, and I would ask you the same question now. I asked them, why did you obey that? And why did you obey? Why did you and your girlfriend at the time obey that and not just say, to hell with that, we will see who we want to see?
Well, my attitude was, I don't care. You know, they can take me, they can arrest me, you know. But my girlfriend is more conservative than me and took the view that, you know, took the government line, if you like, you know, I don't want to catch COVID. Do you know what I mean? You know, and she was in a state of fear and panic. You know, my attitude was like, you know, I don't care what they say. If I want to go and see my family, I'll go and see my family. And I'm doing that now. You know, I'm in Aberdeen at the moment, but my family are all in Cardiff. I've got no support network up here. So the only support network I've got is to go out of the borough. Now, I'm taking a chance every day that I could get stopped by the police. And so be it, because I will challenge their £30 fines or their £1,000 fines. I'm prepared to put my neck on the chopping block and say, well, come on then, let's do it. You know, and that's the way I am. You know, I've successfully sued and taken the authorities to court on 6 separate occasions, and I haven't lost a case yet in the courts where I fought for my rights. So, yeah. You know, I am well known for standing up for my rights, but not everybody's the same as myself. And nobody, you know, and COVID is scary in some respects. I understand that, but when your girlfriend doesn't want to catch it and thinks that she's going to catch it from me, even though I'm only around the corner from her, I'm about 8 minutes away from her, and she doesn't have the same views as what I do, that's where the complexities come into place and that the conflict comes into place.
You mentioned there about the, you know, the PTSD, and we hear a lot on television and radio at the moment about mental health, and you've likened what has been happening and how it is affecting people. You've likened it to being locked up when you were wrongfully imprisoned for so many years for a murder you didn't commit. You would compare it to that, Michael. You really would.
I really would, because although my body is free, my mind isn't. You know, prison leaves you, but you don't leave prison. I don't know whether, you know, you get my gist, what I'm trying to get at. You know, yeah. I've left prison, I know that. But my mind is still there. I still feel locked up. I still feel cooped up that I can't do what I want to do. As I said, I've got a, you know, they're trying to make out that I'm a criminal for breaking the law just to go and see my own family, when in fact, the only one who's breaking the law is the policymakers, because Article 8 is quite clear that everyone has a right to family life and private life. And that's all I'm asking the government is, don't push me into a situation where I have to take you to court. And unfortunately, they put me in this position because I'm not going to just sit down and take it and accept whatever the government says. You know, I know COVID's a real issue. You know, if I had it, I would self-isolate. If I was ill, then I would do the right thing. But because I don't suffer from COVID and I got no problem, it's like a joint enterprise where they're saying, well, there's a few people who are not obeying the rules, we'll punish them all. And that's exactly what is happening right now. We're all being done by joint enterprise just because of a few who do have it and who won't self-isolate.
The Welsh government is taking a very, you could argue, very draconian approach, maybe more draconian than the Scottish government or the UK government, you could say. And how is that? I mean, you're interacting with people. What about your own family? How do they feel about that? I mean, they've even talked about blocking the country off to people who might be living in areas with high cases. Like, I'm in Salford, as you know, and they're telling us all the time that cases are on the increase in Salford, Michael. However, hospital admissions are not up at Salford Royal. There's no evidence in the community I live in that people are sick or suffering, but they keep telling us this, meaning that if I tried to go to Wales, if Drakeford has his way, I might be turned back or arrested if I refuse to leave. What are your neighbours and friends and your family, what are they saying about this? How do they feel about these measures being imposed in Wales? Because it seems to be worse in Wales.
Well, I think there's a big fear factor at the moment because of the, you know, the statistics, the government, both governments, you know, in England and Wales especially, I think they're scaremongering the public. I do not know anyone in my community who has had COVID. And yet, we're in a lockdown, the Ron and Cynon Taf area of Wales, as well as Bridgend and Glamorgan. They're all shut down, yet when you ask the government about the statistics, it's all if, buts and maybes, or what could occur, rather than what has occurred. So, you know, my personal view is they have abused too much of our human rights. It's not just Article 8. There's a right to freedom of assembly, to protest. There's a right to mix with others. I mean, these are basic human rights. You know what I mean? These are not something which can be trampled on or shouldn't be trampled on like they are at the moment. I mean, we're going back to the 1600s or maybe even the 1200s when the Black Death and stuff like that was about, where they, you know, they put a cross on your door, like, you know what I mean? If you had the plague or something, you had to stay in your house and stuff like that. You know, this is how draconic these measures are.
You're referring to the Human Rights Act 1998, of course. If there was a government spokesperson here, he or she would say, Michael, that's all very well, but we've given ourselves these powers under the Coronavirus Act 2020. We've given ourselves these powers, and they were waived through Parliament by the Labour Party, and they were given the nod of assent by the House of Lords. So they would say, look, we're in a pandemic. It's difficult for everybody. Everybody has got to do the best they can in these circumstances, but this is the way it is. And again, under these Coronavirus Act powers, we do have the right to do that. They would say that, you know, your likelihood of succeeding, Michael, might not be great. How would you respond to that?
Well, you know, I accept about the Human Rights Act, but I'm more interested in the Human Rights Court of Human Rights, which we've been signatories since 1966. Now, as far as I'm aware, there's only in exceptional circumstances, and this is what it all boils down to, what is exceptional and what is proportionate to interfere with a right to family life? Now, I think if it went to the European courts, they would take a different view. They would take a different view completely. I think these are not minimum restrictions. These are maximum restrictions and the, you know, interference with our rights.
And there doesn't, there doesn't seem to be any way out of it, does there? I speak to Simon Dolan occasionally. He was on yesterday, Simon. Was it yesterday or the day before? It might have been yesterday. The days just bleed into one another. And he's engaged in his own battle with the UK government. And while all of that is going on, incredibly, you've got the government saying, we'll keep us in limbo on the three-tier system. And you have the Labour Party demanding that we go into another national lockdown. And scarily, even more scary than that is, and I don't like to use those types of words, but you've got the health secretary saying that this is basically going to carry on until such time as we have a vaccine. So there doesn't seem to be any end in sight, Michael.
Well, that's what concerns me. I think it's somebody like me or somebody like Mr. Doolan who see it for what it is and feels like, you know, they can't lock us down forever. We shouldn't be in house arrest. We haven't committed any criminal offences, so therefore why are we being treated like criminals? Because that's how I feel personally, that I'm under house arrest because I can't go to X, Y and Z, and when you do, you've got to wear a mask, and then you've got to go 2 metres apart, and if you're not 2 metres apart, you'll get arrested. I mean, I've never seen anything like this in my life, and I don't know if we'll ever see anything as draconic as what they've done with these rules. And what I'm concerned about is, when's it going to end? When are they going to stop abusing our human rights? When are they going to stop and realise that this COVID is here to stay? You know what I mean? It's not going to go away. You know what I mean? Locking us down, all it does is slow the virus down. But as soon as they open us back up again, the numbers go up again.
Yeah.
This is what they're telling. Now, if that is indeed the case,
yeah,
I'm not a fan of Donald Trump. But he said something the other day which I thought was very important. He said, we're going to have to learn to live with this rather than us, you know, living in pigeonholes, if you like.
He did say that, didn't he? But at the same time, he wants people to take a vaccine within the next few weeks. that, I mean, I wouldn't touch it with a barge pole because, well, I wouldn't anyway, but certainly not one that was rushed out in a few months. Let me remind our listeners, Michael O'Brien is on the line today from Aberdare. Michael is one of the Cardiff News Agent 3. He was wrongfully convicted of murder and spent 11 years in jail for something he didn't do. Can you imagine that? I couldn't imagine it. There is a book about it called The Death of Justice by Michael O'Brien, and I reckon it's well worth a read. Michael is taking the Welsh Assembly, well, he's taking the Welsh First Minister to court over this and challenging the legality of this and claiming that it infringes upon his human rights. And he cited in the case, he cited the fact that he was in a relationship, it was going well, it was a young relationship, but because of the measures, because of the inability for people to mix outside of, or mix in other people's houses, that it put a big strain on the relationship and it didn't progress. So he's taken the Welsh First Minister to court over this. This is very interesting indeed. Lots of comment on this on Twitter, understandably as well. The Welsh First Minister, of course, Mark Drakeford, in the news because he's talking about maybe introducing a circuit break lockdown, a full lockdown in Wales, just as has happened in Northern Ireland today, and also banning people coming to Wales from England, depending on where they are originating from, depending on the case numbers there. Well, all we can say, you know, Michael, is good luck with that, mate. People will watch that with great interest. I know the South Wales Echo covered it. It's a substantial enough story that you would imagine other newspapers would have covered it. But when I went looking for it online the other day, I can't find any mentions of it in the national press. That must be disappointing.
Well, it is disappointing, but not surprising, because if you have a look at all the mainstream press, not one of them is going on about human rights. Not one of them have tried to protect the public's human rights in any way, shape or form. You haven't even heard anything from the groups called Liberty, which is a well-renowned group in London who talks about civil liberties all the time. But the silence is deafening from these people. It beggars belief. You know, marriages are being ruined because of these rules. You know what I mean? Relationships are being damaged. You know what I mean? Family relations are breaking up. You know, and nobody's saying a word about it. And I find that really astonishing. You know, in this day and age, and especially with a number of newspapers like the Independent, the Guardian. I don't expect the Sun newspaper to say anything because they're a yes paper. But some of the more progressive papers like The Guardian and The Independent, you would expect them to say something, and yet they haven't said anything. Even the Private Eye magazine, which is normally very vocal against the government, have said absolutely nothing. And that is shocking.
It's big news, Michael. It's big news because the Welsh authorities have acknowledged they've acknowledged the action. They've accepted that it's there. The Welsh government said, we confirm that we have received the correspondence. And, you know, it'll progress from there. So it is big news and it should be covered. It's astonishing to me that it hasn't been. And maybe people might call me naive. I wish you the very best with it. And you can stay in touch with us and keep us updated on it. Mental health's a big thing here, isn't it? What must it be doing, this situation and the arbitrary measures and the constant changing of the measures and jumping, flip-flopping from here to there? Yes, we will lock down. No, we won't. Now we'll have a tier two. We'll have a tier three. It must be affecting people in ways that maybe are unimaginable to somebody like me. It must be hitting people's mental health pretty hard.
Well, I think, you know, I don't want to go on about myself all the time because this isn't just about me. There's a lot of people like me who are afraid, they're afraid to go forward. They're afraid to tackle the government, you know, because I've taken the government to court before. I don't see it as, it's just like a normal day job to me. Like, you know what I mean? Because they're always breaching somebody's human rights. But when it affects me and I'm allowed to take them to court, I hope there's a bigger and wider picture here where it helps many other people with mental health and people who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and things like that. Because it's very important. People have no idea, and I'll give you an idea what my everyday life is like. I still suffer from what I saw when I was in prison. I watch people murdered, inmates on inmates, killing each other. And I've seen seven people killed in Long Lat in prison in Evesham. And you can check out the statistics between the time I was there and by the time I left. And I've seen some horrific things which I wouldn't want any of your listeners to ever witness. And I have to live with that every day, trying to go to sleep in the night and remembering these people who have died. And I watch one die in front of me. This is not normal. I thought it was normal, you know what I mean, in the end, because that was happening on a regular occurrence.
Yeah.
So I have to live with these things. I lost my daughter when I was inside. My stepfather died when I was inside. I mean, I lost my liberty. My marriage broke up. I had two children. One of them died when I was in prison. I mean, I lost one in 2012 as well, since I've been released. My other son died of a genetic disorder. I've managed to bounce back from that. So all these things, it's not just one particular issue. All of it in the round, you could, no matter how strong a person you are, it takes a toll on you. And being locked down and you can't go out of your house, it's like being in prison again. And that's how I feel. And I know there's a lot of other people who feel the same way as me, who haven't gone to prison, but still suffer from post-traumatic stress, you know, ex-soldiers, you know what I mean, things like that, all over the country. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people who disagree with me, but I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people who are saying, yes, Mr. O'Brien should take this forward. This is right. And will be for me. So I know I'm not going to have everybody on my side, but, you know, I'm doing what I think is right, not in a malicious manner, but I just feel I have no choice to do this, because what else can I do? Just sit in my house and be depressed 24 hours a day, drinking coffee and tea and not knowing what to do? There's only so much housework you can do, and there's only so much, you know, computer you can do. What else are you supposed to do from that?
Michael O'Brien is our guest. You don't have to go down this road, Michael. I wanted to talk a little bit about, just as briefly as you want or not at all, about your own personal story. But before that, I mean, obedience, Michael. Are people too obedient? Are they too quick to follow the rules and regulations without questioning them, do you think?
I think so. And I got to be honest with you, before this miscarriages of justice happened to me, I believed every word the government said, the police said, the lawyers, you know, everybody in official capacity, I believed. I had no reason to disbelieve what they were saying. And it's only when the bubble is burst and something happens to you, like what's happened to me, that your mind is actually opens. And once it's open and you see the system for what it is, you can see. I mean, Winston Churchill, he might not be everybody's cup of tea, but he did say one good thing. He said, the system is run on lies, lies with an element of truth. And that man, that was when he came out of power. And that is so true.
When I've interviewed a few people over the years who were wrongfully convicted of pretty heinous crimes. They didn't do them. I've interviewed people like Paul Hill and Jerry Conlon going back years. I could name a few more. I interviewed men who spent 15, 16 years on death row and were reprieved very late on. And I sat there mesmerised listening to these men and feeling that I'm not as tough or as hard as maybe I think I am, and feeling I could never have coped with what they went through. Your case is very, very well known, and I was looking into it today, and I've got to say this. Michael won a huge civil case against South Wales Police back in 2000, in the early to mid-2000s, 2006 it might have been, 2007. And the conduct of the South Wales Police in prosecuting the three men that were found guilty of the murder of the newsagent back in 1988, that the conduct of the police was absolutely shocking. Philip Saunders was the newsagent that was murdered, and Michael and two other men were arrested for it and should never have been arrested from the get-go. But from there on in, the conduct of the police, it reads like something out of a film or a John Grisham book. It's disgusting. It's so obvious that these men didn't do it. Michael O'Brien didn't do it. And he won a massive civil case against the police in 2006. Thank God for that. How does any man cope when you're in a dock and you're found guilty of something you didn't do, you know you didn't do it, and you're facing a life sentence. How do you cope with that? What goes through your mind? Are you numb? Are you angry? Do you want to cry? How do you deal with that, Michael?
Well, I think I had a number of those things. I can remember when I first went in on remand, I thought it was just a horrible dream. I sat on the bed in the cell. I can remember falling asleep then late that night, thinking I'm going to wake up in the morning and all this is going to be gone. This is just a nightmare. This is just a dream. And then when I woke up and realised that I was actually in a prison cell and this was actually happening, I nearly had a nervous breakdown. And I remember one of the prison officers saying to me, "O'Brien, get yourself together." And I couldn't get the words out at the time, but my brain was telling me to tell him, if I could get my head together, don't you think I would? But I just couldn't get the words out. And I'll never forget that. It was November the 30th. We'd been in on remand for a couple of weeks, and I was in an emotional state like I've never, ever been. I just could not believe what was going on. And I just... Well, no, I lost my daughter just before the trial as well. My daughter died of a cot death when I was waiting for the trial. Christ. So I was traumatised by my daughter's death, as well as being traumatised by being wrongly accused. And then I had to face the trial. And, I was very, very tearful, upset, angry. I had a mixture of emotions. I don't know how I managed to get through that time. There were some wonderful people I did meet. There was a friend called Jason Baker, who was a good friend of mine. He was a big lad, And he said to me, "Listen, you've got to start eating," because I wouldn't eat. And he was bringing me food and he was helping me and doing what he can. And there was, regardless of what people say about other prisoners, if it wasn't for some of these prisoners, I probably wouldn't be alive now. And Jason was one of those persons. And I hadn't seen him for 30 years. And I recently met up with him a couple of years ago. And ended up living with him. So, that's the circumstances which I found myself in. But if it wasn't for people like Jason, I probably still wouldn't be alive.
You think the human being is capable of coping with anything? Because you saw, as you mentioned earlier on, you said you saw, and I know, I believe you, you saw seven people being killed. I can't imagine the violence that you saw. And, as a decent bloke going about your business, before all of that happened, you wouldn't have known much violence or seen much violence. Yeah, it was like a living hell being in prison for those 11 years. And yet you came out the other side of it. We must be capable of taking anything, Michael, really. I don't know. What do you think?
I think you adapt to your surroundings. You've got two choices. You either sink or you swim. So, I had two choices. I either tried to rectify the matter, I educated myself, which is what I did. I want to mention that because I had no qualifications when I went into prison. And I studied law. I changed the law six times. Once when I was in prison, access to journalist case, they were allowed to visit prisoners who were maintaining their innocence. That was another case I took to the House of Lords. And I was self-taught in law. And so there was a lot of positives that come out of my wrongful imprisonment, if that makes any sense to people. I know they might think that's a bit, that's quite heavy. But I looked at the positive things, and you've got to look at the positive things as well. I've wrote six books, by the way, as well. I'm on my seventh, which is being published next year, about death row, Texas death row. I wrote two award-winning books. I won four awards for the first two, Prisons Exposed and the Death of Justice. So I educated myself when I was in there, and I used my time wisely. And my message to anybody who's listening to this program, if they've got loved ones in prison, please educate yourself. You've got to do it, because that's the only way you're going to get out. And I would be my one piece of advice to anybody. If you can't read and write, I couldn't read and write when I was in prison. I learned. I went on education lessons. I took City and Guilds. I passed three English exams, three maths exams. I done a City and Guilds level one. And there was no stopping me. I studied law. I became a prison lawyer because I used to do all the human rights stuff for the prisoners as well when I was inside.
Has anybody asked about writing a screenplay, Michael, about your experiences? Because it's very Shawshank Redemption, really, but actually even more compelling in so many ways.
Well, I've had a few murmurs of people writing stuff, and there was an actress in Wales who wrote a script But unfortunately for me, excuse me, the Sherman Theatre was looking at it. The person got moved on to another theatre, and nobody's taken it up since. So, you know, there is a script actually wrote there. It just needs to be put into place. And I'm hoping that with what I'm doing now, that maybe in time, I'd love to see a film being made. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
I think Danny DeVito will play me.
Danny DeVito. I'm looking at a photograph. I'm looking at a photograph of you now. I could see that. I could see Danny DeVito getting the lead role. Tell me, I mean, you talked about education there, and you said that if anybody's listening and they have a youngster, God forbid, that ends up in prison, look after themselves. Now, I hate to be a negative Nelly, but I'm going to be a little bit negative. One of the things I'm very worried about, Michael, is the increasing and encroaching privatisation of prisons. And when we start turning prisons over to corporations, we're in trouble. I have a friend who was a governor of Mountjoy Prison in Dublin for many years. I wonder, did you come across them? John Lonergan is his name. For nearly three decades, he ran Ireland's most famous prison, and he's one of the nicest, most, well, he's an angel, a great, great man who did everything he could for prisoners and rehabilitation, and he's loved by prisoners, ex-cons, hardened cons. And he talks a lot about when we start giving over the care of prisoners to private corporations, we're in serious trouble, because obviously they only exist to turn a profit, and they won't care whether a young man leaves prison with it better off than he came in. You know what I'm saying? So do you worry about the privatisation?
Yeah, I am. I know the one prison in Birmingham which was privatised, and it was taken over by G4. It was a well-known prison in England. And when they took over, it got so bad there that the government decided to put it back into public ownership again.
Yeah.
And that was only recent. So that goes to tell its own story that, you know, prisons for profits is not good, because there's no rehabilitation. You know what I mean? It's not in their interest to rehabilitate the prisoners if they want profit out of prisoners. I mean, we've seen that in Europe, America, you know what I mean, where they're building all these prisons. And they're making large amounts of money out of these inmates. These inmates are doing meaningful jobs, you know, silly little jobs, mailbags, and this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
But it makes the system clean. And I mean, but that's not rehabilitation. And if they really talk about, you know, the criminal justice system, and they want to better somebody's lives, it has to stay in public ownership. It can't be private.
Yeah, because obviously corporations look to save as much money as they can, so they don't feed prisoners properly. They don't get enough time, obviously recreation time, as much as they should. They certainly don't get the education that they might need. Michael, anytime you want to, I'm really enjoying speaking to you. So if you can stay on with me for a few minutes, I'd really appreciate it. But if you need to go anywhere, just tell me, and I'll be happy to let you go. But I don't get too many opportunities to speak to people like you, so. It's great to pick your brains, but can you stay with me for another 10, 15 minutes, do you think?
Yes, no problem at all.
You sure? Marvellous. Michael O'Brien is our guest, folks. Michael is in Wales and Aberdare. He's very well known because he was sentenced to 11, well, he was sentenced to life in prison for a murder he did not commit back in the late 1980s. Dreadful time for him. He's written about it. It's many books about it. We're talking to Michael today because he's taken the Welsh First Minister to court over the legality of the lockdown, because Michael believes that it's having a terrible effect on people's quality of life and that breaches his human rights. And we're going to follow that really closely. But he's obviously very interested in the rehabilitation of prisoners. He basically turned himself into a lawyer when he was in prison. He educated himself in prison, got lots and lots of qualifications, and has written so many books. Great to have Michael on the programme today. You know what I was just thinking, you know, speaking to you, you mentioned Texas a few minutes ago. When I was a younger man, I used to spend a lot of my time advocating for the abolition of capital punishment around the world, but I used to particularly focus on the United States. And I personally knew a gentleman whom was executed in Florida many years ago, in Jacksonville in Florida. I hate the death penalty and capital punishment. And you're writing about this now, you told us. Is this what, are you writing specifically about capital punishment in Texas, Michael? Tell us about that.
Yes, the book I got at the moment, I've just signed a book deal with Waterside Press in England. And what I've done, I've looked at the cases where they've executed, you know, innocent people. In my view, I mean, there's quite a few cases there. There's 16 in total. The youngest person who was executed was 14 years of age. Okay, it wasn't a Texas case, but it shows you the racism and everything which was involved in those days. A guy called George Stinney Jr., he was 14 years of age.
Yeah, I remember.
He was supposed to have two white girls, and they executed him. And they found out 70 years later that he didn't do it. I mean, that is horrifying. You know, I've got an 8-year-old son. I've got another son as well. You know, and I mean, I'd be horrified, you know, if my son or daughter was executed and then 70 years later they decided to clear their name. The death penalty has no place in a civilized society today. This is another dragonic measures, if you like, you know, which I feel an outdated practice is medieval. And it has no place in a civilized society.
No, it doesn't.
Be civilized people.
That story you mentioned about George, am I right in saying that there was a made-for-TV film about that many years ago starring Louis Gossett Jr.? Am I right? I think so.
I think there was a film about him. Another one is in the cinemas at the moment is Cameron Todd Willingham. He was supposed to have killed his daughters in a fire. And they later found out that the fire was started accidentally, but they tried to make out he did it deliberately. It was electrical fault. They executed him in 1976.
Wow. George Stinney, that's horrendous, isn't it? So you're focusing specifically on men that were executed, and it was later proved beyond a reasonable doubt that they didn't do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Robert Pruett as well is another one. He was supposed to have killed a prison guard. There was a number of prison snitches, if you like, you know, who were involved in the killing and put him in the frame. He was wrongly executed back last year. And there is evidence there that he couldn't have done it. And I mean, I feel very emotional when I talk about these people's cases, because that could have been me.
Of course, we abolished capital punishment in the UK in 1969. Of course it could have been you. Less than 20 years later, when you were wrongfully convicted, if capital punishment was still used in the UK, we probably wouldn't be speaking, Michael.
Well, I work on a number of cases, not just on the death row cases, but I also work on a number of English and Welsh cases. And there's two cases, like Guy Morris, there's a TV documentary going on the air on BBC on the 22nd of October. And there's new evidence in that particular case, which points to serious wrongdoing on behalf of the police. Again, South Wales case, again. Doesn't surprise me. But and there's also a case I'm working on, a guy done 35 years in prison for something he hasn't done. His name's Ray Gilbert.
Do you not?
35 years.
35 years in prison for something you didn't do, and you believe the man is innocent. Jesus.
Absolutely. His case mirrors mine, where one of them confessed to the crime for something he hadn't done after many police interviews and bullying tactics and denial of access to lawyers. And as soon as he got access to a lawyer, he said he didn't do it, but then they still went ahead. There was no forensic evidence, there was no eyewitnesses. In fact, there was eyewitnesses. I'll give an example. In the one person's case, there was a 201 statements which were not disclosed to the defence in Ray's case. And yet he's still trying to get an appeal with the Criminal Cases Review Commission. And I'm working closely with Ray. I met him inside as well. And I know him inside and out. And he knows me inside and out. And we're still supporting each other. Very important case. Same as Di Morris. Di Morris is totally innocent in my view. I don't stick my name lightly to anybody's case.
Yeah.
I like to investigate it. I like to know the ins and outs. I want to know warts and all. You know, the good, the bad and the ugly, if you like. You know, and, you know, there's no doubt about it. The two cases I've mentioned, I believe we'll be hearing from again soon. And one day, they will get their name cleared. And another one is Jeremy Bamber's case.
No, well, I was just, you beat me to it. I was going to bring up Bamber as kind of like a final question. And I'll tell you what I'm not going to do today. I'm not going to argue with you. I should argue with you, but I won't. I'll tell you why. I've had some representatives of Jeremy Bamber on the programme in the past, and we've had a good conversation. It was very nice. And, you know, they explained why they believe that Jeremy is innocent, and I put the other side of the case to them, and it was a very good back and forth. I won't do that today because we're going to run out of time in a couple of minutes anyway. But you've been to see Jeremy Bamber. Now, White House Farm, most of our listeners in the UK must have seen the ITV dramatisation earlier this year or last year, so they'll be familiar with this case. It's one of the most famous cases in UK history. Why are you so convinced that Jeremy is innocent? Go on, I'll give you the last word, and I won't argue with you. Go ahead.
Well, I actually was in prison with Jeremy Bamber. I was in Long Latin with him, and I actually know him personally. And, you know, there was a programme the other night, I don't know whether you're aware, on Channel 5, which showed the new evidence, which showed that he couldn't have done it. I'll give you an example. The prosecution alleges that the silencer, that was put in the silencer, had to come from Sheila Caffell, when in fact it was inconclusive and could have come from one of the Blanchflowers, one of the other family members. If that's indeed the case, he's been convicted on blood, which wasn't Sheila's, and it proves that she could have done it. She could have killed the whole family. And that was Jeremy's main argument at the trial, and he's been steadfast in that for nearly 33 years.
This was on Channel 5. I didn't see that. I wasn't even aware of it. I must look and see, can I watch it on demand? Because it's so controversial, isn't it? You know, when I spoke about it on the programme a couple of years ago, I got a lot of emails from people connected to the family, and they were, you know, screaming bloody murder that I'd allowed Jeremy's supporters on the show. I mean, it's so contentious and so emotional. And I just said, look, I did give them a chasing. I did argue with them. I did put the other points across. If you'd like to come on, you can come on and I'll treat you the same way. But they never came on. It's so contentious. So I'll watch this programme on Channel 5. Do you think he'll ever be left out of jail, Jeremy Bamber?
Well, I know he's going for a new appeal. I know his solicitor's called Mark Newbury, and I can't go into the details of the new evidence he's got, because obviously it's sub judice, because the Criminal Cases Review Commission, but he's got significant new evidence which shows what was said at the trial could not have happened. And it certainly should clear Jeremy Bamber's name. And I will never waver from Jeremy, because I know him personally. I've sat down with him. I know the ballistic test of the ladder. There's so many different things in the programme which went out the other night, which you've got to look where the money's gone to as well, you know what I mean, and follow the money trail and why people said what they did. I mean, Julie Mugford, which is his girlfriend who put him in, if it wasn't for the fact that the so-called hitman she mentioned had an alibi, there would have been another innocent man in prison charged with accessory to murder. But he had an alibi, luckily. So if she was disbelieved on that point, why believe her on anything else? And she was given £25,000 from the News of the World to give evidence against him.
We'll have to pick this up again. I'll have to get some of the other side on, because you know it's still in the consciousness of the public in this country. It hasn't gone away. People are still as interested in it as they ever were. Michael, I want to finish with where we came in. Good luck with your case against Mark Drakeford, the Welsh First Minister. I think whatever happens, I think you've got every right to bring the case. These arbitrary rules, these acts, they brought in the Coronavirus Act, and of course the statutory instruments they've given themselves without getting parliamentary approval. It's dreadful. It is in breach of human rights. I have no doubt it is. Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, as you said yourself. I wish you the very best with it. Thanks for coming on today, mate, and I hope you'll stay in touch and we'll catch up again in the future.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. That was Michael O'Brien. What a fascinating man Michael is, in so many ways, really, having gone through what he went through, being wrongfully convicted of a murder, being sentenced even to life in prison, having to deal with all of that. The terrible things that happened just before being convicted. His daughter died of court death even, and he explained to us how he got over his time in prison. A couple of guys in there, maybe hardened cons, maybe not, put an arm around him, took him under their wing. He educated himself in prison, became almost a lawyer, and eventually had that conviction quashed, and in 2006 got £300,000 in compensation as he won a civil court case against the South Wales Police. Fascinating stuff. 15 minutes, quarter past six it is, on Wednesday. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford. Where else? Back with you in a moment. And we'll have a look at what's been going on in the old news. Let's see, has anything happened, any development since we began to chat today? Back in a minute.
Renowned healer Mark Byerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Byerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbyerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Welcome back to the program. When I was chatting with Michael O'Brien there, I must be tired today. I'm not really. I don't feel that bad, to be honest. He mentioned a case that he's looking into, the case of George Stinney. George was an African-American kid in Carolina, and back in 1944, he was executed in the electric chair for something he did not do. We know. Well, they knew at the time he didn't do it. Later on, they knew he didn't do it. He was executed for, allegedly, he was supposed to have murdered two young white girls. One of them was 7, one of them was 11. And I know a bit about the case because one of the things I used to do when I was much younger, as I said, was I used to write letters to men, it was men, not men and women, but men specifically, on death row in Texas and in Florida. I was appalled when I was younger. I can't remember exactly what triggered that. I'm pretty sure I saw a film, a dramatization, about somebody who was executed in the wrong. It's wrong anyway. I've said this a million times. I've had these arguments with people. In fact, I don't know if I mentioned this to my Jean Ann, the great Jean Ann Crowley, but one of the things that happened after I got to know Jerry Ryan, the great Irish radio presenter and television presenter, God rest him, after I got to know him, went to see him in Dublin, and there was a chance that I was going to go and work with him or for him on his 2FM morning programme. Never materialised, but spent a bit of time with him. But he was fascinated by my interest in capital punishment as an Irish guy. You know, why would you be that interested in it? And we talked about it. And eventually he put me on the air opposite somebody, God love him, whose daughter had been raped and murdered. And he was in favour of the death penalty. I remember that. And I was debating the gentleman, having, of course, the utmost respect for what the man had gone through, even though I could never imagine it. How could you ever imagine it? Somebody doing something so unspeakable to somebody you love. But I don't believe that even if somebody did do that, that the state has any right to punish somebody in that way. The state should not be exacting revenge on behalf of a private citizen. And I will take that to my grave. Now, the gentleman I was speaking to on the morning, all I remember about him was that his name was Stan. His name was Stan, and he was in Florida. And the reason I was talking to Stan was, again, because the man who had raped and murdered his daughter was about to be put to death. Yeah, that it had to be. It's so long ago now. I'm not even sure if Stan was his real name, but it was Stan or Stanley. And I said to him, listen, Stan, this is my argument. How could I ever understand your loss? But I would exonerate you if, having discovered what happened to your daughter, if you got your hands on the bastard who raped and mutilated your daughter, you have every right to do with him as you will. And when I say you have every right to do with him, two wrongs don't make a right, I would forgive that if I was a judge. If I was a trial judge and you were brought before me and the story was, having discovered what happened to your daughter, you managed to get to the criminal before the police did and murdered him. I'm quite happy to think that you're not a threat to society. You've never murdered anybody before. It's incredibly unlikely you're ever going to murder anybody again. So I would sentence you to time served and wish you all the best in getting over what happened to your daughter. But the state has no right to keep somebody in prison in a 6-foot by 8-foot cell for 23 hours a day, with a television playing loud outside the cell, with guards walking up and down, mentally torturing the guy, talking to him about his impending date with the executioner. The state has no right to do that and should never have any right to do it. That's my argument. And I'll believe it till the day I die, you know. But like I said, something happens to you, well, your opinion can change very quickly, very dramatically. But yeah, that's how I feel about it. And I used to do that. I used to write to these men and send money, not much money, but stamps and stuff like that, or money for stamps, I should say, and various things, and talk to them. And, you know, yeah, that's how I got into it, really. But not for a long time. And sadly, I don't have any of those letters anymore. They were lost in transit over the years. But back to, I'm meandering now, as I am prone to do. Back to George Stinney. George never killed these two young girls. He was 14 and he was tiny. He was very, very small for his age. He was undernourished and very, very small, very tiny. And it was absolute kangaroo court stuff. And they executed this poor kid. And Louis Gossett Jr. made a film about it. It's called Carolina Skeletons. And it was made for TV, but I'm pretty sure you'll be able to get a copy of it if you felt like watching it. Very hard to watch. Very hard to watch. Because the scene where young George is brought into the execution chamber is very, very graphic. It's dreadful. And the young boy who played him in the film is a brilliant actor. It's dreadful stuff. That's what went on, you see. One or two of you, I'd love to get your opinion on that, you know. Especially my US-based listeners. The programme has got a very healthy listenership in the United States. Tens of thousands of people tune in from various parts of the United States on a daily basis. So I'd be interested on your own take on it, you know. Anyway, 22 minutes past the hour. Let's take a tune. We'll come back then. And there's a bit of vaudevillian news, would you believe? Isn't there ever? There's a bit of vaudevillian news. This song I'm playing now, when it was out, first of all, when it was first out was the 1970s. When it was out a few years ago for comic relief, it was played so often. It was played so often. We began to loathe it. We reviled it. It was played so often. But I've not heard it for ages. And I thought I'd hear it again. It's a great song. Tony Christie. And Is This the Way to Amarillo on the Richie Allen Radio Show for Wednesday, the 14th of October. Right, Tony Christie, yeah, comic relief, Peter Kay and all that. I'm going to take my leave of you in a couple of minutes' time. 90-minute show today. Ah, shut up. I was on for 2.5 hours on Monday. Shut up. And I have a packed show tomorrow, Thursday. Couple of bits of news which are very important and very tragic. And I don't know. I don't want to end on a negative. But it's been announced this evening in the last half an hour or so that the Christmas markets in Manchester, if you live in Manchester, if you live in Salford, the northwest, you'll know that the markets are amazing at Christmas time in Manchester. They're absolutely amazing. I mentioned Jean Anne earlier on. She was here one Christmas a couple of years ago, just before Christmas, and we walked around at the city centre. They blanket the city centre. They're German-themed markets. They're amazing and wonderful and lovely. And they've been cancelled because of the ongoing COVID pandemic. They've cancelled the markets. See, we're in October, mid-October. They're cancelling the Christmas markets here in Manchester. Amazing. I'm also hearing that some gyms in Liverpool, this is very interesting, this is developing now. This is developing, I don't know. Some gyms in Liverpool are refusing to close, despite the city being pushed into despite the city being put into tier three, high tier, the very high tier. There's medium high and very high. these new tier levels of restrictions. The Liverpool has moved into tier three, which means that bars have to close, they're not serving food, all of that, right? And gyms and casinos and all of that sort of thing have to close now. But Chris Ellerby-Hemmings, nice double barrel surname, Chris Ellerby-Hemmings, co-owner of Empowered Fit Gym in the Wirral, said, "We are not staying open for financial gain. We're staying open for our members' mental and physical well-being." Number of gyms saying they will stay open. They refuse to close. That's going to be very interesting. So what has the BBC done? The bastards. The BBC has contacted Merseyside Police for comment. The BBC, eh? Eh? BBC is reporting on gyms that are staying open for the well-being of their members. And the BBC is asking the police effectively, what are you planning on doing about it? Yeah. And another story that's doing the rounds, in fact, I might have tweeted it just before coming on air, is an amazing story coming out of Birmingham. Birmingham City Council this afternoon admitted that used coronavirus test kits were handed out to households in Selly Oak in Birmingham as part of the drop and collect service, where the city council turns up, gives you a test kit, you test yourself, you wrap it up and you give it back to them. Used tests. I mean, this is vomit inducing stuff. Tiverton, however you pronounce it, on Tuesday, students were given tests that had already been used. Jesus Christ, huh? Huh? I know some of you will be pissed off with the blasphemy. Staggering stuff, this. It's a lie. All of it is a lie. And it rolls on, seemingly, with little or no opposition to it whatsoever. 29 minutes past six. I'll take my leave of you today. Thanks to Michael O'Brien for being our guest. Extended conversation with him if you missed it. It'll be available on Podomatic, iTunes and Spotify later on. I'm back with you tomorrow. I have a couple of very interesting guests. I'll tell you more about that on social media. Until then, going to leave you with this from James Taylor, his version of his former beau, Carole King, and a horse song, I should say, You've Got a Friend. Until tomorrow, thanks for listening today. Bye for now. When